This show was previously broadcast live on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
My guest today is Rachel Rudolph. Rachel is professor of Middle East and Islamic Studies at Emory and Henry College. Her research and her writing focus mainly on resistance strategies, especially Islamic movements in Algeria, Palestine, and the Philippines. Her books include Terrorism and Politics, Mobilizing Movements, Mobilizing Contemporary Islamic Resistance, and Saudi Arabia's War on Terrorism. And she's currently working on a new book about the war. I believe the title is The War on Gaza, but I'll let Rachel correct me if I'm wrong. It's about the Gaza War a little over a year ago. Is that the right title, Rachel?
Well, Saeed and I have went back and forth. We're not sure on the actual title once we finish the manuscript. We've debated, played around with the Gaza War and its aftermath, as well as calling it the Gaza Holocaust.
Publishers have a way of deciding what they will title the book. And of course, what they always have in mind, Rachel, is what can they say to stimulate the most sales? And I can't imagine any author would object to that, right?
Yes.
Oh, can I ask one aside question?
Sure.
Oh, well, I'm debating whether I should even ask it or not.
Oh, no, go for it.
Oh, even though you concentrate on the Middle East and Islamic studies, you mentioned to me a day or so ago that something exciting came up. You'll spend 6 weeks in Russia this summer, but you didn't explain exactly what that will entail. Want to do it now?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I'll be in Russia for 6 weeks at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, working on Russian foreign policy towards Palestine, and in particular Hamas. Because as you know, Russia, as well as many other countries in Asia and the Middle East, do not designate Hamas as a terrorist organization, but rather as a legitimate resistance movement, as well as a political party that won the elections in 2006.
It sure did win the election.
I'm sorry.
Oh, that really sounds exciting. I can hardly wait to get more information once you've gone through this.
I'm extremely excited.
We can exchange emails while you're over there.
Yes. Yes, of course we can.
Let me just say categorically, Rachel, and we're both on the same page as this. Unfortunately, the U.S. State Department lists Hamas as one of its terrorist organizations. Outrageous. Hamas is the democratically elected government of the Palestinian people. The government of the Fatah government led by Mahmoud Abbas in the West Bank. I call it what it is. It's the coup d'etat government. That's what it is. And there are countries like Russia and, I believe China, Iran, Venezuela. I think a good many countries that recognize Hamas for what it is. It's a legitimate government. It is not a terrorist organization. We do concur all the way in that one, don't we, Rachel?
And that we do. That we do.
Oh, we could begin in so many directions today, Rachel. One thing, I finished up this morning doing an article on the possibility of the so-called peace process resuming inspired me to want to go back and write about it. So I've got an article that I finished this morning on it, and Vice President Joe Biden is in Israel right now, and in recent days he said we need to revive the peace process and do it as soon as possible. That's enough to get anybody like me and you riled, Rachel. It certainly gets me riled because I've been looking for that peace process for the last 42-odd years. I haven't found it yet. So I titled my article Peace Process Hypocrisy. Stillborn from inception, it sure has been. There is no peace process, and that's what I write about. Want to jump into that topic because I'm very eager to hear your views on it.
You're absolutely correct in terms of the fact that peace negotiations have been ongoing, the problem, the bias nature of those negotiations, and the blank check Israel has been given in terms of the rights granted to it in that process and what the potential outcome would be in that.
Even though there's been a process, at least in name, Rachel, it certainly hasn't been one in practice, and even listeners familiar with the various stages that really began in 1991, I guess it was, at the Madrid so-called peace conference after the Gulf War. But back in 1947, this one is really easy to slip by. In 1947, before Israel became a state, the UN held a peace conference in Lausanne, Switzerland, and propose the right kind of provisions for a pre-1948 settlement, but Israel at that time turned it down, and of course has been obstructionist ever since, from 1948 until 1967, really the occupation. It just obstructed everything, but of course it did the same thing afterwards. Complicitly with its partner in Washington, partners in crime, Rachel, Israel and Washington together allied for the same agenda, to assure that Palestine is locked down, remains occupied, and Palestinians get no rights. It outrages both of us, and you've written about it. I sure have done a lot on it. Oh, jump into that one.
Well, you know, what's interesting is the fact that we're talking about the restarting, or our governments are talking about the restarting of peace negotiations while there's a continuous rebuilding, or not rebuilding, but the continuation of settlements. The recent, just a couple of days ago, the lockdown of the West Bank itself by Israel, and yet they expect the Palestinians to come to the table to negotiate. And Biden announces the notion of indirect talks because of the continuation of settlement. And yes, the United States has condemned the ongoing settlement building, but condemnation is not enough. I mean, settlement building has been ongoing. The systematic repression and oppression within the West Bank, and including the systematic killing that took place during the Gaza War and before and afterward.
Indeed, settlements have been ongoing.
Yeah.
The occupation began after the June 1967 Six-Day War, and settlements, Israel had its plan. I mean, it wanted to colonize all the territory it wanted, mainly in the West Bank, the most valuable area, and its water resources and so on. Of course, Gaza has value, too. More offshore, I think in recent years we discovered that offshore, Gaza has a fair enough amount of gas and probably some oil there too, and that it's in Gazan waters, but Israel wants it for itself. I don't know what stage of development that is, or even if it's begun, but I know that Israel has done something to make arrangements with the oil gas developing companies. To go after those resources, and use them for itself and deny them the Palestinians and the revenue. And not a word about this gets reported.
There were also some reports done in the British media regarding some arrangements that the Palestinian Authority, and particularly Mahmoud Abbas, had signed with Israel regarding the oil off the Gaza Shore.
So there are arrangements already signed?
In terms of what was reported within the British media. Now, I haven't looked into it further. All of that is in part of the ongoing research for the manuscript for the new book. I mean, we had hoped to have it out a year following the Gaza War. It's just there's just so much material that just keeps coming up and that should prolong the publication of it for a thorough publication.
Oh, you're doing the right thing to delay the publishing date and keep getting as much more information as you can, Rachel. And some of this is so important. The fact that that Gaza has a gas and likely some oil reserves, my goodness, I would say that's another reason for going to war with Gaza. Not that Israel wants to station troops there permanently, but they want to control Gaza. They disengaged disingenuously back in the summer of 2005. I think the disingenuous part, Rachel, being that Israel did not want settlers in the line of fire when they decided they wanted to attack Gaza. So they got them out, and they just seized more West Bank land to transfer them to.
Gaza has the potential to be the Palestinian economic gem in its future state, because of its location, as well as its resources. And so Gaza is not only vital, but you can also understand then why Israel is so reluctant to grant it. Or Palestine sovereignty itself, because of the resources that Gaza, the potential resources Gaza has.
It really is. It surprised me the first time I learned that there were resources there. It sounds like you've given me another topic to look into it, and maybe do still another article on the occupied territories, Rachel, if I can get specific information on the deals that are cut. I think I've seen some estimates, potential estimates of what might be there offshore, but I don't remember them. I don't remember them, and I know I mentioned them in one article I did many months back, I think over a year ago, maybe a couple of years ago now, but I don't remember what the numbers are. We're not talking about Saudi Arabia size, but we're talking about something substantial enough that Israel absolutely wants to control it and use it and profit from it. So it's there, and if Abbas has cut deals with Israel, then one more black mark against him. Mahmoud Abbas, the president, who really is no longer the president, Rachel, because his term expired, is it over a year ago now?
Yes, it was January 2009.
January 2009, no new election called, and the guy is governing as president illegally, along with every other illegal thing he's done. I've got another gem in my article where he's cutting a deal. Put together a report. Saeb Erekat, his chief negotiator, put together a report funded by a UK-based free market think tank. And he forgets all about the right of return. He forgets about other basic things, and he basically surrenders Palestinian sovereignty to Israel. And he doesn't even represent the Palestinian people because he has no legitimacy to negotiate anything for them. The only body that has the legitimacy is Hamas, but Israel won't negotiate with Hamas. And Washington backs that, so here we are. You know, we move around square one, Rachel, and keep ending up right back at square one, getting nowhere. And of course, the peace process is fake from start to end. Can I give you a quote I used at the beginning of my article? This came from a 2000 article by another gentleman. I'll let people read my article and get it all. But it came from the summer of 2007. And the title of his article was The Great Middle East Peace Process Scam. But the other great line in it was, he called it likely the most spectacular deception in modern diplomatic history. And I take out the likely. It is the most spectacular deception in modern diplomatic history, without question, because you can call it what you want, and the U.S. and Israel can use whatever glorious rhetoric they want to, Rachel, but it always comes down to the same thing. There is absolutely no interest or possibility that they will negotiate any kind of a peace with the Palestinians.
No, and if you look back to the Oslo Accords, I was doing some research on European or EU-Israeli relations, especially with respect to military aid, but that's another side project. And during the Oslo Accords, one of the benefits given to Israel for signing or for agreeing to go to the table and for signing was the promise of an upgrading of relations between the European Union and Israel itself, because Israel had been wanting an upgrade of the 1975 agreement that it had with the European Economic Commission, where its economic access to European markets was limited. And so it wanted not only greater access, but a balance out of trade, because I forget what the actual numbers are, but there's a significant amount of European imports into Israel and less of exports from Israel to Europe. But Europe itself in the European Union is Israel's largest trading partner. But all of that affects the peace process, peace negotiations, in getting Israel to agree to anything.
Rachel, the recently concluded the March 1-3 Russell Tribunal in Palestine covered this in their proceedings for 3 days in Barcelona, Spain, and. I was involved in hosting a program about it a week ago Saturday, 8 days ago, and with guests that were selected, and I was asked to host the program, ran an hour and three quarters. We went over these things, including the fact of what Israel's obligation is supposed to be, how the EU should respond when Israel fails in its obligations, and Israel and the EU states, 27 member states, are in violation of international law by letting Israel get away with what it does and not hold it accountable under the law. All 27 EU states are obliged to uphold, including not just Geneva and the better known international law ones, but their own Lisbon Treaty. And I listed a whole list of things that treaty has. It just covers the whole gamut of human rights and equal justice and democracy and the works. Everything is there, spelled out in plain, simple English, and all EU states have to abide by this. And one of the provisions is that these states must uphold fundamental international law, like the Geneva Conventions and so on, and they don't. They give Israel a pass. They are supposed to not give Israel a pass if Israel fails to also live under the law. Well, Israel gets all the benefits. It has none of the responsibilities, and it gets away with murder, literally. And this goes on, and the Russell Tribunal paid a lot of attention to this and cited it. And a lot of frustration, too, Rachel, because this stuff comes up again and again and again, and the world community, with very few exceptions, lets Israel get away with murder. Somehow, this has to stop.
Everybody, the United States, well, the European Union itself is the largest donor, but the United States is one of the second largest donors. We pay for what Israel's actions against the Palestinians, and yet we have economic difficulties. Europe has economic difficulties. Is there an outcry among the population for a change in that? Very few. There are groups, there are organizations, NGOs that are attempting to mobilize to influence the laws, especially with funding to Israel, but there's not enough force behind them in order to have them change.
Oh, there's no muscle behind it at all. Again, the states say one thing. I think this was another frustration in Barcelona, that the states rhetorically will say a lot of the right things, but then in practice they simply step aside and do nothing. Going back to when Israel was allowed to become a UN member, Rachel, I'm sure you understand this better than I do. Israel was obliged, among other things, to observe, to become a UN member, you're obliged to adhere to the UN Charter. Well, that's about as basic as it gets for a UN member. Well, of course, Israel never adhered to the UN Charter, but no action was ever taken to punish its officials for what it did.
No, and what's interesting in terms of if we look at sanctions in other states that have been penalized by the United Nations for its violations of the Charter, actions have been taken under Chapter 7 of the Charter. But in with respect to Israel, none of the condemnations and the resolutions that have been passed that Israel violates have been done under Chapter 7, which kind of means it's nothing more than verbal condemnation or verbal slap on the hand to Israel for its actions, and it has no authority to
And the
to
main reason is because the Palestinians, in the eyes of the world community, aside from their being human beings, which is the only thing that you and I care about, they have nothing to bring to the table. They have no power, no wealth, well, they have some resources, but of course Israel is co-opting them. So they basically have nothing, where of course Israel has tremendous might and all the rest, and of course the backing of Washington. So they have a lot to bring to the table. There's a quote I remember seeing, Rachel. I've never used it. I need to find it again and use it at some time. We're going back to the Balfour Declaration days, sometime around that time frame. Early part of the last century, and in the post 1917, Britain said to the Zionists who wanted to colonize Palestine that essentially, don't worry, the land is inhabited by a group of powerless Negroes. They used the term Negroes. And I forget the exact language that was used, but it said they have no worth and they don't matter, so don't worry about them. You know, we worry about the people that we want to worry about, but don't worry about these useless people. So I mean, we just can't shove them aside and do anything we want to do, and that was back 90 years ago or so, and of course that's exactly what's happened from that time frame to today. And the Palestinians have systematically been displaced and have suffered and lost their rights, and nobody cares about them. The hopeful thing for me, Rachel, is that lots of people like you and me, and I wonder how many really, but I suspect millions of people, growing numbers, are very angry about this, and they've begun in recent years especially to do more and more to fight for the rights of Palestinians, and the most hopeful movement I see is the global BDS movement, boycott, divestment, and sanctions. I think Israel worries about that one more than any other, and that gains adherence all the time. Because of what I do, they made me a cultural member. Oh, I'm just delighted about it. I support it. I've written about it a few times. And through nonviolence to get to boycott Israel economically, culturally, in ways that will hurt, including boycotting companies that do business with Israel, this is how to inflict pain without killing anybody. And maybe take one more step down the road to finally getting justice for people who've never had it since at least the Balfour Declaration.
You know, the reminds me of with the Russell Tribunal. The second session is on, I believe it will be occurring in London at the end of this year, but it's taking place to look at the role corporations have in aiding not only Israeli occupation, but Israeli violation of international law. And one of the, what the BDS campaign is doing is particularly important with respect to the focusing on corporations because of the capitalist system, operating within the global community. That has more of a threat than attempting to, mobilizing to get states to sanction. Now, states sanctioning Israel economically, culturally, and politically would be ideal as well, but going after corporations, better strategy for mobilization, in an attempt to thwart Israeli action against the Palestinians.
Oh, I agree. I absolutely agree. You hit them in the pocketbook, and that's where they feel it the most. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't attack corporations. But it really is so easy if people will do it. Both Israeli corporations exploiting Palestinians for profit, exporting produce from the occupied territories, an illegal act, whatever comes out of the occupied territories is the property of the Palestinian people, not Israeli corporations that go in and plunder the area. So not to buy their products, and other companies, U.S. companies, European companies, that really, in the eyes of the law, are trading with the enemy, and if you hit them where it hurts, this will get their attention. If enough people do that, stop buying their products.
Yeah. One of the other things, because one of the largest industries within Israel is the telecommunications industry. For BDS and individuals, ordinary individuals who are not part of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions program can engage in that as well. I mean, and finding out what companies in the telecommunications sector is a part of the Israeli network itself, and you go after them, as well as weapons production, arms sales. I mean, that's another one, especially because of the link between not only Israeli arms transfers and sales as well as purchasing with the United States and the European Union. And so you target telecommunications and arms sales, and that's ideal.
Rachel, at the bottom of the hour, I like to take a couple of minutes break just to let you and my other guests catch their breath. Let's do that, and we'll come right back.
This show was previously broadcast live on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
With Rachel Rudolph, talking about occupied Palestine, the crimes that Israel is committing, crimes committed also by its partner in Washington. Doesn't matter what administration in Washington is in power, the crimes go on. Rachel, you were mentioning targeting the defense companies. The only difference between looking at the defense companies and telecommunications ones, food producers, other consumer products producers is we as consumers can stop buying food and cosmetics and things like that. But we don't buy too many F-16s, do we?
No, not at all. No. But at the same time, because look how much governments spend on their military budget. And so targeting the arms companies brings attention to that, and then you can link that to the domestic issues taking place, you know, the increase in the loss of jobs, especially among Americans and especially among the South in the United States. Education is an excellent example. Many of the different cuts, Virginia, the state of Virginia, what they've had to do because of not having the money for their education for the upcoming year is unbelievable. I mean, so the United States itself is in bad shape economically. And so targeting that and bringing attention to the fact that we're spending so much money on war, on defense, it can help. But yes, you are absolutely correct. The ordinary individual, the ordinary person, and not those that will go out to the different weapons companies and protest, but those we can look at the things that we purchase, especially orange juice. We can look at the labels on the orange juice to determine and purchase something that is not directly supporting Israel.
It's not just the makers of F-16s, of course. The whole defense industry goes way beyond the so-called defense contractors. You've got all the related areas, the related industries. Probably the biggest one is technology, because without the technological sophistication, these weapons wouldn't work.
Right.
So, and you've got companies, it gets a little tougher though when you go after them. A company like Intel, very supportive of Israel, and lots of us have computers and they have an Intel chip in them. Well, you know, we want to own a computer and we don't usually choose it. Well, maybe we do, I don't know. We choose a computer, and if it happens to have an Intel chip in it, we may or may not know that. So many of them do. I think virtually all of them do, if not all. The great majority of them do. You're stuck. If you want to own a computer, then maybe you're forced to do business with Intel. It gets a little tougher there. Other products are easier, but you raise a very important related topic, the fact that we're spending all this money on militarism, because Israel does too.
Mm-hmm.
Israel, a major arms producer. And such a sizable proportion of their spending goes to their military budget for a country population size about the size of Greater Chicago, and they've got what some people believe, and I've said it, is the world's fourth most powerful military. I mean, virtually any sophisticated military weapon they have in their arsenal, including at least a couple of hundred nuclear bombs, maybe hydrogen bombs, and delivery systems to certainly spray them across the Middle East. So Israel spends all that money. We spend all that money. And a program after program here in the U.S., Rachel, it seems to get worse with each succeeding administration. So Obama, as bad as George Bush was, I like to say Obama did the impossible. He's even worse than George Bush, and he is. He absolutely is doing things that George Bush wouldn't have imagined. But Obama, under the cloak of he's a different kind of president, so far has been able to get away with it. I mean, he won't forever. His approval ratings are going down, and people will finally have a grand awakening and not want to put up with this anymore. But we spend all this money on militarism, foreign wars. We look for new targets. Iran may be one. There's talk
Venezuela.
Of
Venezuela. I was reading some reports just last night on news reports on with Clinton's visit all throughout Central and South America, and it sounds as if she's on the warpath against Venezuela.
Some
of the analysts are suggesting, you know, is it Venezuela next? Are they the next target in the United States war?
They absolutely want to get rid of Hugo Chavez. There is no question about that. Whether they want to go so far as to start dropping bombs, Rachel, I don't know. There are enough lunatics running around Washington that I don't put anything past them, including lobbing a few nuclear bombs at another country like Iran. Somalia is again in the spotlight. A talk going around that we will attack Somalia one way or another. Well, we have for many, many months using Ethiopia as a proxy. But, you know, I mean, the U.S. Air Force can start bombing Somalia. So we haven't done enough to them over the last 20 years or so. But and this stuff goes on and on and on while vital national concerns go unaddressed.
Mm-hmm.
And another initiative yesterday in his weekly radio address, Rachel, Obama reiterated the fact that he wants to remake education in America, referring to below college education. What you and I refer to as public education. Well, I wrote about that a couple of years ago. Under George Bush, No Child Left Behind. He wants to revive No Child Left Behind, which is a scheme to destroy public education in America. That's all it is, to turn it over to predatory profiteers who will make a profit center out of public schools to provide less education to kids who we don't want to educate, poor kids, inner-city kids. Because why do we need to educate them? We want to use them as serfs for the day when everybody will be a serf. So why bother educating people who don't need an education? We'll just worry about educating the well-off people in the country. That is the plan. Obama is backing it, and he'll come up with some new name to replace No Child Left Behind. But the idea is to destroy public education. The system, for me, Rachel, in inner-city schools in Boston in the 1940s and early 1950s, I finished high school in 1952, they got me into two top schools. Today, that is absolutely impossible, with a rare exception here or there. But other than that, it is absolutely impossible. And Obama, our first black president, wants a system like this.
You know, the conditions in the United States are really interesting. I want to go back to Venezuela just for one second, and then I want to come back to the U.S. conditions. What's really interesting is with Clinton beating the warpath, at least verbally, against Venezuela and Chavez in particular, the fact that, you know, one of the things that Chavez has done in its foreign policy is funded many of the very poor communities, urban poor communities in the United States, by subsidizing their electricity needs because of our economic crisis. And so attacking Venezuela has the potential of bringing U.S. domestic conditions to the forefront even more so than it would ordinarily in the past. And studying resistance and studying mobilization, you know, that has its roots in the notion of not just revolution, but violent conflict throughout the world. And what's really, really interesting with the United States, because I'm not an Americanist. I could tell you more about the domestic political situation and governance system in most of the countries in the Middle East, in contrast to the different localities within the United States. But given the changes in the conditions I started following, especially because of my emphasis on resistance, and if you look at conditions in the past in other areas, Central America, South America, where there's been the outbreak of resistance, the United States has those conditions. Those conditions are prevalent. And so it will be interesting to see within the next 15, 20 years? What takes place? And what type of movements emerge?
I don't know if we have 15 or 20 years to wait, Rachel.
But change takes time, and it will get a lot worse before it gets better.
That's what I'm afraid of, that it will get a lot worse, and you're bringing up Venezuela. Venezuela is a very important country to me. I call the government they have the best model of a democratic state of any nation in the world that I know. And that's the reason that Chavez gets targeted by the Bush administration, by the Obama administration. I've used a line that is absolutely true, that he represents our greatest threat in the region. And the threat that he represents is the threat of a good example. He really is a good example, and the possibility that could spread, and people in other countries wanting the system that Venezuela has and managing to get a leader in power that would give it to them. There's no other leader around like Chavez.
No.
Oh, a couple Chavez that are...
Chavez reminds me of Nasser in terms of his charisma and the ability that he has to unite via his personality. We could talk about Venezuelan economy, and we could talk about the political situation. There are some issues that Venezuela needs to overcome. But that you have issues in any country. The United States, America, is not a perfect democracy, and some could even argue whether it is in fact a democracy.
Venezuela?
No, I'm sorry, the United States. I'm just saying in terms of Venezuela with it being in the transition or in the process of democratizing, it being a democracy. All democracies have problems. But Chavez himself, as a leader, he is charismatic, and he reminds me a lot of Nasser. And I see in Chavez the ability to unite not just Central but also South America.
He really is charismatic. And because his popularity is very high, it always fluctuates a little bit, but it has been over 60%, I think, solid year after year after year. So the idea of somebody running against him and having a chance to win, it just won't happen because he does things for so many people in the country that they never had before.
But not only domestically, internationally as well. And Chavez has a very fascinating foreign policy. I mean, he uses oil, and he subsidizes oil, not just throughout Central and South America, but in Africa, in the Middle East. I mean, he looks or targets areas where there's conflict, where there are problems. And so that helps as well.
He's done it in U.S. cities, Rachel,
yes.
As well.
Yes, he has. And that's why I said targeting the fact that our politicians, our leaders, are on the warpath, at least verbally, against Venezuela and Chavez is problematic, considering his foreign policy and what he is doing within the United States in terms of helping the lower socioeconomic classes in the U.S. in helping with our poverty, with our energy crisis, with our economic crisis.
I didn't read Hillary Clinton's comments about Chavez. Do you recall any juicy ones that she said?
Oh, I would have to look them. I don't remember them off the top of my head. I'd have to look them up.
But she made some very sharp comments about him.
Yes, she did.
Well, this has gone on for an awful long time, and of course the U.S. media, the dominant U.S. media, goes after Chavez on and off, blaming him. All the good things he does, he gets assailed for twisting them on their head. He governs as a benevolent Democrat, and his people respect him greatly for it, and the U.S. media use that to beat up on him all the time. And I mean, there is some quotes, or just quotes from U.S. officials, especially under George Bush. I'm not certain if anybody in the Obama administration has called Chavez another Hitler. I think Rumsfeld once called him that, another Hitler. I mean, you just have to take a step back and take a deep breath and say, does anybody really believe this rubbish? But unfortunately, people who don't know what's going on, they hear this stuff and they think it's the truth, when the truth is exactly the opposite of that. So it's up to people like us, Rachel, and many others, and programs like this one and the others that Progressive Radio puts out, and other alternative sources, to set the record straight and get more and more people piped in to what the real facts are. And this is the way to win that struggle. It's not easy, as we both know. It's very frustrating. No matter what we do, we're up against. As Hitler once said about the Pope, way back in those days, how many divisions does the Pope have? Well, we don't have any divisions, so we have to use the power of our collective voice and hope that over time that can make the difference. I think it can if enough people just keep at this.
It can, and with the especially within the United States, what makes it ideal is the fact that we are suffering economically. It's the best time for collective mobilization for change within the United States, not just economically but also politically. And not just, I mean, going beyond America's borders, but the conditions are ripe throughout the world for global mobilization, for change, for adherence, for getting states to adhere to international law, for getting preventing countries from violating.
I absolutely agree. The idea that I think the time that gets ripest for change, Rachel, is when conditions, economic conditions or political conditions, are so dire. Political, repressive, economic, people losing their jobs and their homes and their savings, and the government isn't doing anything to help them, and they really begin to feel enough pain, and then finally there's an awakening that government is the enemy, not your ally, and they decide that if we don't do something ourselves, nothing at all will get done to help us. And at that point, those are the sparks that revolutions are made of.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't look forward to something violent in the streets, but I do look forward to people finally reaching or passing a threshold where they say they need to understand this, and it takes an awful lot before maybe they do, that government will never give you anything. They will never give you anything. The only way change can possibly come is we have to take it. We have to take it.
But that is what revolution is. Revolution does not mean the use of violence. Revolution is about change. It's about bringing change. It's about the collective mobilization for that change. I mean, that is what a revolution. I mean, it's unfortunate that revolution is considered synonymous with violent resistance. But it's, you know, violent resistance is a means. It is not what is a revolution. A revolution is nothing more than change and the call for change.
Well, you and I both want revolutionary change, which simply means the old system is broken, it's corrupted, it's not working, it's causing harm. Revolutionary change is something entirely different. We need to erase the slate and start all over again. And do things that will benefit all people, not just a very, very tiny slice, the elite at the top. And that's what we have, and it gets worse all the time in the U.S., Rachel, since going back to the 1970s. Incomes have either stagnated or declined. There's been a systematic transfer of wealth from the majority of people, well over 90%, to a small elite group at the top, and the disparity is maybe the greatest it's ever been in U.S. history, certainly at least as great as it was back in the 1920s, but it keeps getting worse and worse and worse because the crisis that we're going through is not getting better. It is getting worse, so people are hurting more, and the policies that have been put in place to address it haven't been to help people. They've been to help bankers get richer than they already are, and corporations, the chosen ones, also to get whatever help is needed if that's the case. And for ordinary people who really are going through the worst times in their lives, virtually nothing is being done. And we call ourselves a democracy. I will never call this country a democracy, Rachel. We need to call it what it is. We are a repressive state that takes care of the well-off and throws ordinary people out like garbage. We are treated like garbage, and that's a system that has to stop.
Right, correct. And, you know, together, not just as Americans, but individuals all over the world have the potential to change, have the potential to bring about a humanitarian revolution, because the conditions that our lower socioeconomic classes here in the United States are experiencing are similar to the conditions of individuals in Germany, of individuals in Britain. And it's together that we can make a difference, not just locally. And locally, I mean in terms of our national presence, but also globally. We have to have one voice. We have to have all of us speaking together for change.
It's up to us, Rachel, absolutely. We're all in this together. I mean, we're talking about, I guess, anything over 200 million, you could say hundreds of millions. Hundreds of millions of us are on our own, and if we don't bring about change, it will never come. There are so many great quotes. One that I pulled out and will use shortly is one I haven't used for a while. The great Margaret Mead quote, the anthropologist Margaret Mead, whose quote I think she said it a number of ways, but it basically was, "Never underestimate the power of a small group of people to change the world," and the tagline is that it's the only way change ever comes, and that's exactly right. It always comes from the grassroots, from the bottom up. It absolutely never comes from the top down. These people will cling tenaciously to everything they have, and they won't give an inch unless we take it from them. So I like to say, what are we waiting for? What are we waiting for? For them to have everything, and we have absolutely nothing. And we're literally out in the street without a home, without a job, and police out there with billy clubs, just clobbering anybody that says, "I can't stand this anymore, I need some help." And the help that they'll give people is a billy club over the head. What kind of a country is this?
Exactly. And you know what, bringing it back to the Palestinian issue and the boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign, you know, the BDS has the potential to move not beyond the Palestinian issue and to be used as a tool for mobilization in other areas in order to wrestle control back from not just the corporations but the political elite who depend on the corporations and lobbyists and interest groups for campaign contributions. And so there are many things that one can do in looking, paying attention to what's taking place. Mass mobilization in support of the Palestinians is excellent strategies for individuals that can be implemented later in other areas.
Rachel, you and I know well what goes on a daily basis in occupied Palestine, militarized, repressed. Just the most true despotism in the territories for over 42 years. I say categorically, what the Palestinians are now going through is coming to America. If we don't find a way to stop it, we will be as deeply repressed one day, and we will be militarized because the laws, U.S. laws, now allow military forces in U.S. streets. Somewhere in the future, I honestly expect to see them there.
And they also allow for the targeting of American citizens abroad that are suspected of engaging in acts of terrorism or aiding and abetting terrorism. Now, granted, the targeting of American citizens abroad has to be approved at a high level, but
assassinating
still,
them.
Yeah, once you have that, you give the state that blank check. There are potentials over time, or mistakes to happen for things to get out of hand.
Again, without question, Rachel, something that wasn't official doctrine before. We have declared the right to kill our own citizens abroad. Well, how much of a leap is it to extend that to killing them anywhere?
Mm-hmm. It has the potential to be brought and used at home as well. Although I think they're not likely to see that in the immediate future because of it's a lot harder for the population to swallow. It's easier for the population to swallow that it's okay to target abroad. Because they're abroad, and if they're abroad, they must be up to doing, up to no good. But it's a little bit harder for them to swallow here, and so the public is there's less of a chance of an outcry for engaging in targeted killings abroad than there would be in the U.S. But at the same time, it, once you open the window to that, it has the potential to be used. And we can, all we have to do is we can study Israel's history of targeted killings. I mean, it's systematically killed Palestinians.
Many, many thanks, Rachel.
Indeed. You have a wonderful day.
Oh, you too. And we will be back next Thursday. We are on Thursdays, Saturdays, and Sundays, noon on weekends. Well, noon in Chicago, 1 p.m. Eastern Time on weekends. Eastern Time at 11 a.m. on Thursdays. Make it a regular habit.
This show was previously broadcast live on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.